This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, the Weyerhaeuser Company has bought McMillan Bloedel, a huge timber company in Canada. Their spokesman will not say if it will honor McMillan's environmental commitments. Tons of space dust have rained on the Earth since our planet was formed. Scientists seeking to learn the origins of life analyze the debris for clues. The rushing Connecticut River threatens the life of the trout fishermen, but the dangers make the views of mountains, fields, and forests more vivid. And on the Earth calendar, plants are blooming on the canyon grasslands of Idaho. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Millions of acres of forest areas may soon be changing hands in Canada. American-based Weyerhaeuser Company recently announced plans to purchase McMillan Bloedel. That's a company that owns the logging rights to hundreds of thousands of acres of coastal rainforests in British Columbia, as well as timberlands in the United States. As Stephen Westcott reports, the acquisition has environmentalists concerned that Weyerhaeuser's clear-cutting practices will further jeopardize the future of BC's old-growth forests.
Weyerhaeuser, the world's largest producer of softwood lumber and market pulp, will spend $2.45 billion for McMillan Bloedel. In return, Weyerhaeuser gains control of vast forest areas in the United States and Canada.
It will add 6.9 million acres to our existing holdings. Most of that is in Canada. There are approximately 427,000 acres that are located in the U.S. South, but most of it is in Canada. And one of the things in Canada that is on what they call crown land, provincial land, which is owned by the government, and then cutting rights are assigned to that.
Bruce Amundson is Director of Financial and External Communications for Weyerhaeuser Company. He says the acquisition of McMillan Bloedel gives Weyerhaeuser control of some 39 million acres of forests in the United States and Canada. Amundson says besides timberlands, a number of mills and processing sites are included in the deal.
We also acquire three containerboard mills that have an annual capacity of 1.1 million tons and 19 converting facilities, which is basically box plants. So containerboard is the actual material that boxes are made of, boxes that you would maybe get shoes in, computers, fruit and vegetables. That containerboard is the actual material, and then the converting facilities are the ones that take that material and then actually make the boxes out of them.
If the sale is approved by the U.S. and Canadian governments, Weyerhaeuser will also get three strand board facilities, which produce a board similar to plywood that is used in construction. More than half a dozen lumber mills located in British Columbia and other provinces of Canada, and a 49% ownership of a company that produces engineered wood products like beams for new housing construction. In all, Weyerhaeuser's purchase of McMillan Bloedel will reportedly boost annual sales from $10.8 billion a year to $13.3 billion. While the deal was quickly negotiated, environmentalists say they are not shocked by the sale of McMillan Bloedel. Charlie Rains is director of the Cascade Checkerboard Project, a program operated by the Sierra Club.
It's not a surprise in terms of large timber companies buying up other timber companies or buying large timber holdings. I mean, we have Plum Creek Timber just bought a huge amount of land in Maine, for instance. And they also bought some down in Louisiana and Arkansas. So these kinds of large transactions are quite common now. I think what you're seeing in the timber industry is in many industries is you're seeing consolidations. You're seeing, you know, major mergers where you have these huge companies that have incredible resources to operate in the fashion they want to. And, of course, the political power that comes with that allows them to put incredible pressure to keep the regulations as low as possible.
In addition, Rains is afraid Weyerhaeuser will attempt to sell off some pristine forest areas for development through its real estate company, which has also been a trend in the timber industry. Last year, McMillan Bloedel pledged to phase out the practice of clear-cutting in British Columbia's coastal rainforests in an effort to preserve some old-growth areas. Environmentalists say only 22% of the world's old-growth forests remain standing, and many quickly praised McMillan Bloedel for the move. But Weyerhaeuser's Bruce Amundson says it's too early for the company to commit to the pledge.
First of all, what we have said regarding their proposal to phase out clear cutting is that we're interested in learning more about it. We, quite honestly, don't know enough yet to be fair to people to really say one way or another what we will do with that. But we do want to get our foresters together with their folks to learn more about that, to see if it does make sense. We certainly are not looking to take any steps backwards. But we also want to make sure that policy allows for regeneration of Douglas fir trees.
Before the sale to Weyerhaeuser was announced, McMillan Bloedel struck a deal with environmentalists and native people in British Columbia to restrict harvests in areas with important ecological and aboriginal values. Weyerhaeuser says it is willing to talk about the agreement with those involved, but adds the company is not ready to commit to that pledge either. The Sierra Club's Charlie Rain says folks in British Columbia should be concerned over the recent sale and believes Weyerhaeuser will continue its preferred method of clear-cutting.
Quite frankly, I'd be very surprised if Weyerhaeuser would buy the company and all its timber-cutting rights and then forego cutting on any significant portion of them. Maybe in, like say, in certain visual corridors or some very selected areas with high cultural values or such, but I think that the ambiguous response by the Weyerhaeuser representative is a pretty clear signal that they are not intending to honor those agreements. They certainly were well aware of them before they acquired the company. They certainly have had plenty of time to consider that, and the fact that they were not at this point in time able to make that commitment, I think, is a pretty clear signal as to what direction they're going to go.
Weyerhaeuser officials maintain the company has been a leader in the timber industry and say it has received high marks from environmentalists in the past. Charlie Rains recognizes that Weyerhaeuser was the first U.S. timber company to begin replanting and says the company has tried to be a good corporate citizen. However, he and others still have problems with many of Weyerhaeuser's harvesting practices. Rain says while Weyerhaeuser isn't as bad as some timber companies, it doesn't mean its harvesting practices are always sustainable, an important feature especially when old-growth forests are rapidly being decimated worldwide. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We continue our series on the search for the origins of life. In previous segments, scientists have told us that organic molecules form the building blocks of life, and the process by which these molecules combined to form life itself is still not understood. Scientists differ about whether the organic molecules from which we all derived originated on Earth or found their way here from space. One thing we do know is that small particles or dust from asteroids and comets continues to fall on the Earth on a daily basis.
There's a continuous rain of this material falling onto the Earth. These particles that we're talking about range in size from so small that you could fit about seven of them across the width of a human hair up to a tenth of an inch or so. And there's about 30,000 tons of this material that falls onto the Earth every year.
That is George Flynn, professor of physics and mathematics at the State University of New York, campus at Plattsburgh. He describes where the dust comes from.
What happens is that comets emit dust as part of their normal activity. You can see the dust tails of comets when they're near Earth. And asteroids emit dust when another object collides into them and causes a crater and spalls up some of the dust into space. And that material then floats around in space until it encounters some other object. Frequently, the Earth's gravity attracts it to us.
Flynn is analyzing this space dust, which is being collected by NASA with U-2 aircraft at about 20 kilometers above the Earth's surface. It is captured before being exposed to contaminants as it descends through our atmosphere. He finds it has some unusual characteristics.
There's a lot of carbon in the particles. We're still trying to characterize exactly what kinds of carbon it is, but there's a lot of carbon in the particles. The typical rock from space, the meteorites that most people are familiar with, have less than 1% carbon, and it's a rare meteorite that has as much as 2 or 3% carbon. These particles have, on average, 10 to 12% carbon, so they're much more carbon-rich. And the work we've been doing has indicated that much of that carbon is in organic form. It's in the kinds of compounds that might indeed be important to starting life.
I asked Flynn what an organic compound in space dust consisted of.
Long chain molecules that consist of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, these are the precursor materials that you need in order to get life started, in order to form biological organisms, single-celled organisms.
Finding organic compounds does not in and of itself tell us how life began, because the building blocks had to combine, a process scientists are still trying to understand. Again, George Flynn.
Nobody really knows just exactly what you need to get life started. That's actually one of the big controversies today. Is it easy to get life started, or is it hard to get life started? Do you need the right starting compounds, or can you make those compounds out of just plain old ordinary graphitic carbon, for example? And human life and all life forms on Earth are basically carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen compounds. And somehow or other, you have to bring all these materials together and end up forming cell walls and having real biological activity. We don't know if that's easy or difficult and exactly what starting materials are required. But certainly having large organic molecules is a help in this process. The ones that started out on Earth, the ones that were contributed to Earth in its formation process, were probably destroyed by the early geological activity of this planet.
A decade ago, two scientists named Miller and Urey exposed a combination of gases to sparks and were able to make amino acid, one of the building blocks of life and the basis of protein. This led to the theory that lightning strikes on the chemical stew that formed Earth's early oceans began the process that resulted in life. Wayne Roberge, astrophysicist from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, says the theory is now discredited because geologists have found that the gases Miller and Urey used were not in our atmosphere 4 billion years ago when the process began. Roberge is exploring the possibility that the chemical reaction did take place elsewhere.
I'm exploring the possibility with my postdoctoral research associate, Glenn Sialek, the possibility that this experiment actually occurred not on the Earth, but in the space near the Earth. We know from observations of other solar systems in the process of formation that the gases that Miller and Urey used are, in fact, quite common in space. Now, whether the energetic processes like lightning occurred to transform those chemicals into more interesting biological molecules, we don't know, and that's what we're working on.
If Roberge is able to show that amino acids did form in space, then they could have been deposited on Earth in the shower of space dust and played a role in the origin of life. My final query was to Professor Flynn from Plattsburgh in the state of New York.
So I realized that one should never ask a scientist to guess, but if you had to guess, would you say that from what you know now that it took this bombardment from space to produce the materials that made life possible here?
It certainly looks like this would be very helpful in getting that process started. I would think it would have been, much of the starting material would have been contributed by this process. It's hard to imagine, since the material is falling in and since it has a very high organic content, why it wouldn't have been used in that process.
We welcome two new stations to the list of more than 200 currently broadcasting The Environment Show, WRVD-FM in Syracuse, New York, and WUSC-FM in Cortland, New York. Coverage of the origins of life is made possible by NASA through support for the New York Center for Studies of the Origins of Life. It's located at the New York State University at Albany, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and the College of St. Rose. The Environment Show is a national production which is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Share your views with us here at the Environment Show. Our address is 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author W.D. Wetherell, it's a piece of the Connecticut River in Vermont where you find the aura of trout amidst dry bug skeletons. In this portrait of place, Wetherell reads from his book One River More, a celebration of rivers and fly fishing.
It wasn't love at first sight, or second, or even third. Seen early in June, its water still busy with springtime cleansing, the Upper Connecticut River has the gray-silver color of a playground slide. A dangerous, slippery one, with treacherous steps and no handrails, something a prudent mother wouldn't let her children on alone. And while a river that has the potential to kill you is in many respects more interesting than a river that doesn't, on this perfect late spring morning, as I pulled on my waders, looked around at the radiant bowl of mountains, meadow, and field, smelled the mica sharpness of rushing water, sensed that vernal crescendo of bursting and triumphant life, I was even more strongly than usual in no mood to drown. So gently was the operative word. To the river, this silver-colored, unknown thing racing past the alders 20 feet below, I would bring gentleness, stealth, efficiency, calm. This, though my skin had already tightened in anticipation of its temperature, my heart was thumping in anticipation of its force. Anyone with a sense of prudence, anyone approaching the downslope of life, will always be respectfully frightened of a strange and powerful river. It's perhaps a tribute to the fact I wasn't quite over the hill yet that this fear, though real enough, only contributed to the fun. Booted, waded, armed with the lance of my fly rod, the visor-like brim of my fishing hat pulled low against the midday sun, I clanked toward the banks, ready for battle. And then, remembering the prudent part, found a boulder and sat down to look things over. What I was looking at as I sat there shaping up my nerve was a river 20 yards in breadth, with a current fast enough to form haystacks against the granite boulders that forced it into a curve. On the far side, the New Hampshire side, was a cornfield that had just been planted. In the middle distance, I could see the red tractor, the sunburned farmer, moving at the head of a vertical halo of chocolate-brown dust. Higher, looking up, were the northern peaks of the White Mountains. Pyramids, a child's perfect drawing, and yet jumbled, lying in a plain that seemed remote from the one the river ran through. Pictures hung on a separate wall. The Vermont bank, the one I sat on, was steeper, with enough alder and raspberry vines to make getting into the river a challenge. A bit to my right, the water that had drawn my immediate interest when I parked, the current pushed hard into the bank to form a long sluice flecked with bubbles, running between a corridor of smaller, sun-bleached boulders, their tips white with bird droppings and the dried skeletons of bugs. There were no insects showing, but the air had the humid softness that generates mayflies. And while this is a hard concept for the non-fisherman to grasp, over everything, Sky, fields, boulders, even mountains hung the distinct and unmistakable aura of trout. One aspect about this portion of the Connecticut immediately enchanted me. Over the years, the current has cut deep through the surrounding clay and loam. So, wading, you can be a good 20 feet below the level of the surrounding countryside, making it feel like you're fishing in secret within a self-contained groove of water, rock, and sky. There on the banks are vines and creepers, great clumps of hay the tractors can't reach, trees in the muddy spots, the raspberries and sumac that help hold things together. By June, these are already high enough to add to the tunnel effect. They're leading tendrils curving out toward the river so the banks are doubled. Still higher, above the vegetation, above the willows, the sky seems channeled in the same narrow blueness, so the entire world, not just the river, is rolled into that flowing north-south line. Occasionally, one bank will crumble away of its own weight, giving you a glimpse over farmland toward mountains. But for the most part, the outer world remains invisible, except for the smell of hay, the rumble of tractors, a distant chainsaw, the harmless rush of invisible cars. More than anything, this serene, self-contained effect is what causes the bittersweet feeling I have when climbing back out at the end of the day. It's a narrow strip of paradise you've been wading through, but paradise all the same.
That was author W.D. Weatherall, reading from his book, One River More, A Celebration of Rivers and Fly Fishing. It's published by the Lions Press. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Native and non-native plants are blooming in Idaho. A number of beautiful wild plants can be found in the Garden Creek Preserve. The creek is a tributary of the Snake River, which forms Idaho's border with Oregon and Washington State. Deep canyons provide dramatic backdrops for the plants in this region, many of which are rare and are found nowhere else in the world. Trish Clare, Director of Science and Stewardship for the Nature Conservancy of Idaho, describes what is blooming in the canyon grasslands.
One of them is the Palouse goldenweed. It is considered a rare plant. It's about 3 feet tall when it is fully grown up and has bright yellow flowers, you know, that sort of bob and nod in the winds that constantly are blowing through those canyons. And it, you know, has several flower heads on top. It has a really stout taproot, so it can go deep into the earth to find the limited moisture that's there in this time of year.
Besides native plants, Claire says alien species have invaded the Garden Creek Preserve and are also in flower. Invasive species are a global problem because they can literally take over ecosystems and outcompete native populations.
The big one that we're dealing with out there is called yellow star thistle. When this thing blooms, the whole mountain turns bright yellow, which is kind of sad. It's very easy to find, but it shows the extent that this thistle has taken over the native habitat. And it's dramatically increased from just a few thousand acres that were infested a decade ago to over 100,000 acres in 10 years.
Trish Clare says the star thistle stands about 2 to 3 feet tall. The leafy spurge, which is a little shorter than the star thistle, has also caused problems for the Nature Conservancy, which owns and manages 1,400 acres in the Garden Creek Preserve.
We also have Russian knapweed, sort of a relative of the yellow star thistle, that has more of a pinkish-purplish flower. The field bindweed, which is kind of grows really low along the ground and has almost a morning glory-like flower, a white-tubed flower, and white top, which is, looks just like it says. It has a white flower that's, you know, right at the top, sort of a 2 to 3 inches across. Very delicate little flower. You know, it's kind of not an unattractive plant.
While many invasive plant species are beautiful to look at, the damage they can do to other plants and wildlife can be devastating. The Greek mythologists sometimes portrayed forces of destruction in the person of gods with beautiful bodies. So too with invasive species. The splendor of some lilies of the fields hides the fact that the invasive lily may kill the field itself. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we talk green about personal watercraft, sometimes known as jet skis. Are they a positive source of fun for people to enjoy lakes and rivers, speed and wind? Or are they noisy polluters that defile the water with gas and oil, pollute the air with exhaust and noise, and make life miserable for swimmers and wildlife? Maybe they're both. A green tip about how the U.S. Senate may be rewriting environmental laws without your ever knowing about it. And an introduced rodent, the nutria, is destroying wetlands in the east and southeast by literally eating them away. Stay with us.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Stephen Westcott. Today we're talking about personal watercraft. These are jet skis and ski-doos that a lot of people enjoy using on America's lakes, rivers, and ocean coastlines. Like snowmobiles and motorized trail bikes, they can be fun to ride. I even rode a jet ski a few years ago and really enjoyed the experience. However, these vehicles do have environmental effects, and today we're going to look at the impacts jet skis have on waterways and our planet. Joining me today are Paul Hansen, Executive Director of the Isaac Walton League of America, a national conservation organization. He joins us from Maryland. And Larry Lambros, Executive Director of the Personal Watercraft Industry Association. That organization represents the interests of personal watercraft manufacturers. He is in Washington, D.C. Paul, let me start with you. Isaac Walton League recently came out with a report titled Caught in the Wake, the Environmental and Human Health Impacts of Personal Watercraft. Generally speaking, what does the report say?
It's a well-documented report, and it says that these personal watercraft significantly pollute the water, pollute the air, disrupt wildlife habitat, and cause a lot of recreational conflict. They're real noisy, and people don't like them. You and I were out on a lake and somebody came by and dumped a couple of gallons of an oil and gas fuel mix in the water, we'd be pretty upset. And that's essentially what happens when these crafts are used. We're not saying that they shouldn't be used and people shouldn't enjoy them. We're just saying that there needs to be some reasonable restrictions on these craft.
Larry, your organization has some fundamental problems as far as how the Isaac Walton League report was put together. Is that the case?
Well, yes, we don't believe that, first of all, they've characterized the personal watercraft appropriately. Number two, in terms of well documentation, what they have done is essentially taken some of the statistics that are ascribed to two-stroke engines, which represent about 75% of the motorboats out there, according to the Isaac Walton League. And they basically used those statistics and applied them specifically just to personal watercraft, which is, of course, a very small proportion of all the two-stroke engines that are being utilized.
Actually, Steve, our report stated very clearly that it is oil-burning two-cycle marine engines, including personal watercraft, that spill 15 times more oil into the water each year than Exxon and Valdez. Unfortunately, we had a caption under one of the photographs that failed to qualify that, and it did read in a confusing fashion. It might lead the reader to think that it's just personal watercraft that spill 15 times more oil into the water each year than Exxon Valdez. It's not. It's personal watercraft and all other two-cycle marine engines. I don't know what portion personal watercraft are of that. We've seen one report. We don't know if it's correct or not, that it is the equivalent to four Exxon Valdezes. Safe to say, these craft, because of how they're used, they don't have a propeller. They have a water jet pump. They have very high capacity. Some of them are 100 horsepower. They're used loudly. They're used, at very high speeds, and they create as much air pollution from one day's use as a 1998 passenger car does for over 100,000 miles.
Well, let me stop you right there, Larry. What is the problem with two-stroke engines? Do you see them as significant?
Well, essentially,
problem for the environment?
The two-stroke engine technology has changed very little for the last, 50 years or whatever. It's an old technology. And personal watercraft in particular, the manufacturers have been working very, very hard and have been spending a considerable amount of research and development money to improve on the current two-stroke technology. They've introduced catalysts that have reduced emissions considerably. They've introduced direct injection engines that basically eliminate any gasoline or that part of the fuel from the emissions.
Let's talk about EPA standards. It's my understanding that the EPA standards for marine engines call for a 70% emissions reduction by 2006. That's the year 2006. Does that mean using four-stroke engines? And if the technology is here, why not make the standards effective sooner? Larry?
Well, actually, it's a 75% reduction according to the EPA.
Okay.
And the fact of the matter is that we have several personal watercraft that now meet those standards. One of them meets the 2006 standard, which is the standard similar to essentially CARB, the California Air Resource Board. That's why, in fact, that's probably one of the few two-stroke engines that's available for use on Lake Tahoe. But what I'd like to get back to for a second here is this comparison to the Exxon Valdez. The Exxon Valdez was non-volatile heavy crude oil being spilled in a very small area of water. What we're talking about in terms of the exhaust from personal watercraft or even from two-stroke engines, you're talking about hot exhaust. These are vapors. It's not liquid. There is not. We're not spilling. We're not leaking fuel into the water.
But as
the Isaac Watkins and Lieben themselves point out in the further part of the report, this part of the exhaust. And
I think I get a chance to respond.
Okay, let me just stop it right here. Paul, let's clarify in terms of the two-stroke engines. As I understand it, the problem is that the gasoline and oil are mixed together, and that's when the pollution, that's what causes the pollution. Is that the case?
Yeah, gas and oil is mixed together, and they're, according to EPA, 25 to 30% of the fuel is introduced into the water unburned. If it volatilizes and becomes an air pollutant, it can be reintroduced to the water in the rain. It's still a pollutant. The Exxon Valdez comparison is a volumetric one. People don't have any idea what these large amounts mean unless you draw some kind of comparison. And nothing in our report stated, I think it's obvious to anybody that these machines don't run on crude oil. I think that should be completely obvious. We also acknowledged in our report that the industry has made some progress. I think we were very upfront about that. But that progress isn't really going to take care of a lot of the problems. Prince William Sound, where Exxon Valdez spilled, is not a small area. Part of the problem we have here is that the industry is insisting that these craft be used on any lake. State of Minnesota recently tried to ban them on lakes under 200 acres. These are pretty small lakes, and the industry fought them very hard.
Okay, let's shift focus just a little and talk about wildlife. Larry, do personal watercraft disrupt wildlife habitats?
A variety of the studies, including some of those that have been utilized by the Isaac Walton League, talk about motorized boating in general, and to the extent that both noise and direct disruption, I think anybody with common sense would agree that when you introduce foreign objects, whether it's a motorized boat or even canoes, into a close proximity to wildlife, it may cause some conflicts. And that's why we have supported through our legislation and through all the other efforts that we have put forth to encourage establishing buffer zones, not only between shorelines and wildlife, but also other users.
Okay, before we get into restricted areas, Paul, in terms of your report, did you find specific examples of how personal watercraft disrupt wildlife habitats?
Yes, there's been a number of studies that show that personal watercraft are 6 times more likely to haze birds, to put birds up into the air, to get them off their nests, to reduce their energy load, and then our other types of watercraft. We found that the PWCs are much, much shallower draft. They're much more likely to get into areas with aquatic vegetation, or much likely against a shallow water habitat where the habitat is much more wildlife intensive.
Many folks find the noise pollution from personal watercraft offensive. Is there any way to make them quieter? Is that something the industry is working on?
As a matter of fact, the industry has been working, and this is, again, most of what is being discussed in the Isaac Walton League report is old technology. The new technology has mitigated the sound considerably. Most of the manufacturers, in fact, have now come out with new models that have reduced the sound 50 to 60%, and they're continuing to work on that.
Paul, what about that issue, the noise issue?
There are a couple of new designs that are quieter, not as quiet as they can be. We certainly applaud that progress by the industry. That should go without saying. These types of watercraft are still a tiny percentage of those that are in use. And I think the industry has to realize that the pattern of use has really created some unpopularity with the American public. Time magazine now has an informal poll of the worst ideas of the past 100 years. PWCs came out of the box at number one, and they were number one in that poll for a while. They've, I think, most recently settled in as number four. The other top candidates are prohibition, the Y2K bug, prohibition, and DDT and telemarketing.
What about the safety issue? Paul, is there any evidence that personal watercraft pose extraordinary risks to users and, say, users enjoying the water, kayakers or canoes, any swimmers perhaps?
Well, I think that the biggest risk of personal watercraft, the biggest safety risk, are ones that the Center of Disease Control and National Transportation Safety Board have found that on average you're 8 times more likely to be injured in an accident in a personal watercraft than any other type of boat. Personal watercraft have maybe, I think it's 9% of the boat registrations, yet they account for something like 39% of the injuries. Most boating accidents are drowning accidents. Most personal watercraft accidents are blunt trauma accidents. So they're dangerous, but they're more dangerous to the users than anybody else.
Some folks say users of personal watercraft should have designated areas where they can use them. By that, I mean blocked off areas, specifically set aside for jet skis. Should federal or state governments create such areas? Larry, what do you think?
Well, I think At the federal level, I don't think it's an appropriate approach. I think that wherever you're utilizing personal watercraft, the federal level is just a little bit too far from the ground, so to speak, or the water. Certainly on the state level, we have, as I said before, been very involved in trying to pass legislation and been very supportive of education programs, of no wake zones, of buffer zones, of minimum age limitations, et cetera. All of these things are designed to mitigate the kinds of problems that can occur when you have multi-use situations. Now, we believe in multi-use management best practices, and when looked at on an individual basis, there is an appropriate possibility in some instances to create specific standards for motorized voting.
Okay.
We don't believe that we should be singled out beyond other motorized votes.
Okay, Paul.
Wait a minute, Larry. You're telling the listeners that your industry is trying to pass legislation to restrict these things. The state of Maine wanted to pass reasonable legislation and did to protect what they call their gem lakes. Your industry fought it. The state of Vermont wanted to pass and did pass legislation to restrict these craft from lakes under, I believe it was 200 acres. Your industry fought it. The state of Minnesota has been trying to restrict the use of these craft on tiny lakes in Minnesota. Your industry fought and won.
I've got one final issue, guys, that I want to get to. Paul, aren't jet skis and boats just part of the American culture, our desire for fun and to go fast? Are there larger environmental issues that we should be concerned with instead of targeting people simply enjoying themselves?
They're a great part of the culture, and we're not trying to target anybody, Stephen. What we're trying to say is that people should be able to enjoy themselves, but they should do it in a manner where it doesn't intrude on other people's enjoyment of themselves, where it doesn't cause, you know, the kind of toxic pollution of the water that some of the fractions of the spilled fuel causes in the aquatic ecosystem, toxins that are very hazardous to zooplankton and to vital plankton. The problem certainly is larger. We need to look at all two cycles, and I think you'll see the Isaac Walton League at our next convention consider a phase out of all two cycles. As Larry pointed out very correctly, this is a technology that's 50 years old, and it's time to move to the newer technologies. They're wonderful.
And we are moving towards the new technology.
Larry, what about the fun issue and other environmental concerns?
Well, you put those things together. I mean, the question, again, as Paul just pointed out, we're talking about a new era with a new technology. We have in discussions with California, as you know, California is in the forefront of establishing norms. We had suggested that by 2008 we would reduce our engine emissions by 82%. They decided to stick with 96.5. But the new technology in terms of abating noise, the new technology in terms of eliminating with direct inject engines, for instance, any of the gasoline, so you're looking at the hydrocarbons that were coming out of the gasoline, all the gasoline is burned. Some of the questions in terms of pollution that are a big issue to mention by the Isaac Walton League and others is MTB, which is a fuel additive that makes gasoline burn cleaner. California, the governor has recognized that that's a huge problem, and he has proposed the elimination of MTB additives in gasoline by 2002. If that happens, and more states, actually I think there's five other states at this point that are also doing the same thing, we will not have that problem. However, I would like to ask the Isaac Walton League, to what extent have they lobbied their corporate partners and sponsors, such as Ashland Incorporated, Texaco, and ARCO Foundation, about taking MTB out of their gasoline?
Okay, that's an issue we're going to have to address on another day on the Environment Show. I want to thank my guests for joining me today. They are Paul Hansen, Executive Director of the Isaac Walton League of America, a national conservation organization, and Larry Lambros, Executive Director of the Personal Watercraft Industry Association. We want to hear what you have to say about this issue. Call our comment line at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Stephen Westcott.
We'd like to hear from you here on the Environment Show. Try our website, www.enn.org. www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. You can also reach us by email, green@wamc.org. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. Activists who try to use their voices to influence how their U.S. senators vote are used to writing and calling Washington in support or in opposition to a particular piece of legislation. Many environmental bills, such as the Endangered Species Act and proposals to open the Arctic Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to oil drilling, have passed or been defeated because of citizen lobbying by environmental organizations and industry-sponsored groups. A change in the Senate rules 4 years ago permits senators to add provisions known as riders to appropriations bills. These have little to do with appropriating money. Appropriations bills have to get passed and signed by the president to provide the money to keep the government running. So a rider can become law that might never pass if it received public scrutiny through hearings and the normal legislative process. The current crop of riders added to this year's Interior Appropriations Bill involve logging, grazing, and mining on public lands, as well as the collection of oil royalties. So if you want to keep a watchful eye on your senators to see if they are voting the way you think is best for the planet, you need to hold them accountable for the riders that are tacked onto appropriations bills. That's our green tip for this week. In the last half hour, you heard about alien plants that can push out native species and disrupt ecosystems. In the eastern and southeastern United States, wetlands are being destroyed by a large rodent brought in from the southern hemisphere. Leah Fleming has more.
With brown fur and sizable buck teeth that are often yellowish in color, the nutria is similar in appearance to a beaver. Experts say this semi-aquatic native of South America can be quite large at times.
Males are reported to grow to up to 35 pounds. I've never seen one that large in Maryland, but they are very big as aquatic rodents go. They look, if anybody's been to a local zoo and seen a capybara, they look very much like a small capybara. They have a tail. It's not quite a nude tail. It's got some hairs on it, but it's not flattened like a beaver. It's a little bit more like a muskrat tail. They look like a great big muskrat with a much more blunt, flattened head that has very large flared nostrils off the end.
That's Mike Slattery, Director of the Wildlife and Heritage Division for the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. He says nutrias are spreading rapidly in that state.
Well, we're not sure exactly how many we have throughout the state now, but we have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of animals. Originally they populated marshes on the lower eastern shore, but they've begun to spread to more northern marshes on Maryland's eastern shore, and we've recently found them in documented populations on the western shore of Maryland, particularly in the Patuxent River watershed and in the South River watershed. So we're very concerned about that spread. The damage that they cause to marshes is tremendous.
Slattery says one of the reasons nutria populations are increasing so rapidly in Maryland is because of the animal's ability to reproduce quickly.
They reach maturity or breeding age as early as 4 months of age, and they come into estrus or come into heat and are receptive to breeding within 48 hours after having had a litter. And litters can, they vary obviously, but will be anywhere from 3 or 4 to as many as 13 animals in a litter, and we've done a lot of sampling over the past couple of years, and what we've found is that throughout the year in Maryland, at any time that we sample the population, 65% or more of all females are pregnant. So that's why it's very difficult for us to keep up with the spread.
Nutrias were originally brought to a private zoo in Louisiana in the 1940s. A major weather event allowed animals to escape, and they multiplied rapidly. Today, they can be found in 24 states across the country, and Mike Slattery says these herbivores are taking a toll on wetland areas.
Many people don't have an appreciation for just how damaging their eating habits can be, but what they do is, rather than nip off vegetation so that it can grow back, they dig out the roots and eat the root mat itself. And that root mat is sort of like a glue that holds the marsh together. And once that is, the integrity of that mat is compromised, it leaves those marshes open to accelerated erosional trends, and the force is very great on it. So it's not just that they dig it out, it's that they leave the marsh mat vulnerable to other forces that act on it and erode it away very quickly.
The destruction caused by nutrias is threatening habitats for wildlife such as fish species and the bald eagles that rely on them for food, as well as blue crab populations. Mike Slattery says the rodents are also displacing native mammals.
One of the very important species that's a component of our ecosystem that is native is the muskrat, and through direct competition for habitat, for food, through the marsh destruction, they have a tremendous detrimental effect on local muskrat populations. And that has us concerned because the trapping heritage and culture on Maryland's eastern shore and the fur market in Maryland is a very important part of the local economy, and that's a resource-based and sustainable economy that's important to the state.
In Louisiana, where wildlife experts say the nutria problem has reached epidemic proportions, officials are encouraging people to hunt nutrias for food and for pelts. In the past, exploding nutria populations have been controlled by trapping. Now, low demand for fur in the United States and Europe has substantially reduced trapping activity. He says Maryland has some of the best nutria hunters in the country, but they cannot keep up with their expansion. While the situation in Maryland is not as bad as in Louisiana, Mike Slattery says nutrias pose a serious threat to the health of wetlands, and says the nutria problem surpasses threats from development and urban sprawl. He says the state is still trying to figure out how to control the spread of the mammal.
Last year, Congress passed a bill that allowed for, it didn't appropriate money, but it allowed for an appropriation of up to $2 million for a pilot study to figure out just how we would be most likely to succeed at an eradication program. It's not to do the eradication throughout the ecosystem itself, it's just to learn how to do it.
Slattery says it will be 3 years before the pilot program is completed, which gives nutrias plenty of time to reproduce and destroy marsh areas in the state of Maryland and elsewhere. For The Environment Show, I'm Leah Fleming.
Is it true that the timber companies that are gobbling each other up caught their predatory instincts from a space dust shower? Does space dust make alien wildflowers bloom in Idaho or nutria eat U.S. senators? It's too complicated to remember, so keep a copy of the show handy for reference. It's show number 498. Order it at 1-800-323-9262. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer. Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.